A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip on Sunday titled The Resistance Liberates and Oslo Destroys. Attendees demanded the cancellation of the so-called Oslo Peace Accord that was signed in 1993. In September of that year, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accord with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accord and affirmed its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
We assert that the shortest way to liberate all of Palestine and the prisoners is through the rifle and the resistance. Armed resistance is the one and only way to achieve the goals and aspirations of the Palestinian people.
The agreement was meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but years after signing the Oslo Accord, Palestinians consider it as a terrible chapter in their history.
The world must understand that the Israeli regime doesn't respect any international accords or agreements and only understands the language of force. The Oslo Accord has only brought pain and suffering and disasters to the Palestinians.
The conference comes almost 4 months after the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war.
The Oslo Accord caused the Palestinian rift, while the armed resistance has managed to achieve several victories against the Zionist enemy. The Palestinians are fully backing the resistance, especially after realizing that the Zionist enemy was the only one who benefited from the Oslo Accord.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Oslo Accord has been a major setback for Palestinians and is even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land.
Palestinian resistance factions say that the futile Oslo Accords will not free Palestine and Al-Quds. They maintain that armed resistance is the key to freedom. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
On Saturday, in the Italian capital, hundreds of people staged a protest against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass, which came into effect on August 6 and whose effects are set to be further extended. The Italian government is planning to make the so-called vaccine passport a requirement for employees at all public sector workplaces, as well as potentially at key businesses in the private sector, including supermarkets. At the rally, protesters were holding banners which read "United for Freedom of Choice" and "Hands off our children."
Non discriminare, lasciare.
We are against all discriminations. People should be free to choose what's best for them, as stated in our constitution. Let me make clear that we are not against the vaccine.
Imposing a vaccine passport is nonsense. It's tantamount to blackmailing people. Furthermore, vaccines are still experimental and there are many unknowns about their effects.
The vaccine passport has been required since early August in order to access cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the health certification has become obligatory for long-distance trains, domestic air flights and schools amid widespread grumblings.
Free vax protests held across Italy over the past weeks have often turned nasty. A few days ago, the police staged raids in several Italian cities against anti-vax extremists, during which weapons such as knives and clubs were found.
Le azioni sicuramente ledono.
These episodes have certainly affected our campaign. Let me add, however, that the media have purposely emphasized isolated incidents with the sole aim to criminalize all forms of dissent. So far, after weeks of protests, 8 people only have been put in custody by the police.
Anti-COVID Green Pass protesters at Saturday's rally in Rome were joined by supporters of far-right party Forza Nuova. An anti-vaccine passport protest was also held in Milan, with about 5,000 people parading in the city centre. Max Civili, Rome.
Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has made a day-long visit to Tehran. During his short visit, he met with the new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. The Iranian official hailed the constructive talks he held with the head of the IAEA, Rafael Grossi, in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Speaking at a joint press conference after the meeting, Islami described the negotiations, mainly on technical issues, as constructive and said confidence building is what matters for Tehran and the UN nuclear watchdog.
Today, Mr. Grossi came to Tehran at the invitation of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and we had good and constructive talks. The negotiations were held in a spirit of cooperation to create opportunities for enhanced interactions within the framework of the International Atomic Energy Agency's rules and regulations. Mr. Grossi will visit Tehran again in the near future, and the IAEA's technical team will also come to Iran to make necessary arrangements for the replacement of surveillance camera memory cards in accordance with the safeguards agreement.
But I'm glad to say that today we were able to have a very concrete result, which has to do with the continuity of the operation of the agency's equipment here, which is indispensable for us to provide the necessary guarantees and the information to the IAEA and to the world that everything is in order and that we are going to be able to assist also to assist Iran in its future negotiations in the context of the JCPOA.
Back in February, Iran and the IAEA reached a technical understanding under which Tehran agreed to keep the camera recordings from its nuclear sites for 3 months as a goodwill gesture in support of diplomacy, waiting to see whether the other parties to the JCPOA could manage to bring the U.S. back into full compliance with the deal. The agreements came shortly after Iran decided to stop its voluntary implementation of the additional protocol that allowed the IAEA to carry out short-notice inspections in Iran, denying the agency's inspectors access to the country's nuclear facilities beyond the safeguards agreement. The decision was made in accordance with the December 2020 law passed by the Iranian parliament, adopt a strategic action plan to counter sanctions that prompted the Iranian administration to restrict the IAEA's inspections and accelerate the development of the country's nuclear program beyond the limits set by the JCPOA. Iranian officials have cautioned the IAEA Board of Governors to avoid miscalculations at its upcoming meeting, warning that taking advantage of the IAEA for political purposes will draw a different response from Tehran. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
In the limelight.
For years and years, what came to be known as America's so-called War on Terror, and later just its forever wars, enjoyed remarkable bipartisan support in Congress, not to say the country at large, says Andrea Mazzarino, writer, in an article published under the heading, Who Authorizes America's Wars and Why Do They Never End? Stay tuned for more. For years and years, what came to be known as America's so-called War on Terror, and later just its forever wars, enjoyed remarkable bipartisan support in Congress, not to say the country at large. Over nearly two decades, four presidents from both parties haven't hesitated to exercise their power to involve military in all sorts of ways in at least 85 countries around the world in the name of defeating terrorism or violent extremism. Such interventions have included airstrikes against armed groups in 7 countries, direct combat against such groups in 12 countries, military exercises in 41 countries, and training or assistance to local military, police, or border patrol units in 79 countries. And that's not even to mention the staggering number of U.S. military bases around the world where counterterrorism operations can be conducted, the massive arms sales to foreign regimes, or all the additional deployments of this country's special operations forces. Providing the thinnest of legal foundations for all of these have been two ancient acts of Congress. The first was the authorization for the use of military force, AUMF, that allowed the president to act against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons. It led, of course, to the disastrous war in Afghanistan. Thinking back to when America's forever wars first began, it's hard to imagine how U.S. could still be fighting in Iraq and Syria under the same loose justification of a war on terror. Almost 2 decades later, or that the 2001 AUMF, untouched by Congress, still stands, providing the fourth president since the so-called war on terror began with an excuse for actions of all sorts. An unnamed senior administration official explained, "We have a responsibility to demonstrate that attacking Americans carries consequences, and that is true whether or not those attacks inflict casualties." He did not, however, explain what those American troops were doing in the first place at bases in Iraq and Syria. Note that such an act was taken on presidential authority alone, with Congress thoroughly sidelined, as it has been since it passed those AUMFs so long ago. To be sure, some Americans still argue that such preemptive attacks and really any military build-ups whatsoever are precisely what keep Americans safe. How many people died in those attacks? Whose lives in those target areas were destroyed by uncertainty, fear, and the prospect of long-term anxiety? It's also estimated that more than 801,000 people died in fighting among U.S. allied and opposing troops and police forces. And that doesn't include indirect deaths due to wrecked healthcare system, malnutrition, the uprooting of populations, and the violence that continues to plague traumatized families in those war zones and at home in the U.S. According to a stunning new report by Boston University's Ben Sheet, the big killer of Americans engaged in the war on terror has not in fact been combat but suicide, which has so far claimed the lives of 30,177 veterans and active service members. Suicide rates among post-9/11 war veterans were higher than for any cohort of veterans since before the Second World War. Among those aged 18 to 35, the oldest of whom weren't even of voting age when he first started those never-ending wars, and the youngest of whom weren't yet born, the rate has increased by whopping 76% since 2005. And if you think that those most injured from their service are the ones coming home after Iraq and Afghanistan, consider this. Over the past 2 decades, suicide rates have increased most sharply among those who have never even been deployed to a combat zone or have been deployed just one. It is hard to say why even those who don't fight are killing themselves so far from America's distant battlefields. As Sui points out, about 42% of Americans are now either unaware of the fact that their country is still fighting wars in the greater West Asia, North Africa region, or think that the so-called war on terror is over. Consider that for a moment. What does it mean to be fighting wars for a country in which a near majority of the population is unaware that you are even doing so? The burdens of America's forever wars are still shared by Americans in concrete ways. More frequent and longer deployments with shorter breaks. More abusive and all-encompassing command structures and very little clear sense of what it is this country could possibly be fighting for anymore or what the endgame might be. If strikes like the ones President Biden authorized last month reflect anything, it's that there are few ways, certainly not Congress, of reining in U.S. Commander-in-Chief from sending Americans to harm and be harmed. Here's the truth of it. Americans shouldn't be spending this much time, money, and blood on conflicts whose endgames are left to the discretion of whoever the increasingly shaky electoral system places in this country's highest office. Until Americans pressure lawmakers to repeal that 2001 AUMF and end the forever conflicts that have gone with it, America's wars will ensure that democracy and the rule of law, as we know it, will make any promises of peace, self-defense, and justice ring hollow. Don't doubt it for a second. War is a cancer on democracy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The UK has delayed the implementation of post-Brexit trade controls. Brexit Minister David Frost says the pandemic has had longer-lasting impacts on businesses, both in the UK and the EU, than observers expected in March. Some argue that such a postponement would give European exporters a commercial advantage over British firms. London has also threatened to suspend the Northern Ireland Protocol agreed with the EU under the Brexit deal last year. Frost says London is ready to take the step if the European Commission refuses to renegotiate the documents. So what's the best way forward? Sticking with the agreement or renegotiating it?
It was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he has announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Furza, London.
Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. And we're bringing post-Brexit issues in the spotlight. Now, to discuss that, I'll be joined by senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams in New York. And journalist and political commentator, James Tui in Plymouth.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Good to have you both, gentlemen, today. Welcome to the show. Now, let's go to Ian. Given the circumstances, Ian, do you foresee a fresh crisis over the withdrawal agreement and arrangements for Northern Ireland?
Foreseeing is a good word, because we're talking about the unforeseeable, allegedly. Mm-hmm. The sad bit, as your commentary alluded, everything here was entirely foreseeable. It was foreseen, it was predicted by everybody except Boris Johnson, was in defiance of reality. I mean, they painted themselves to so many corners. It's government's got a supply of tartan paint. There's so many different coloured stripes. First of all, the Northern Irish Unionists voted for Brexit, but not for the border. They didn't want the border with Ireland. Secondly, the British Conservative Party, which used to be called the Conservative Unionist Party, founded on the bedrock principle that Ireland was part of Britain, basically threw away Northern Ireland in return for getting Brexit on its home patch. And then Brexit itself, these trade restrictions, and it's not as though they're bad things. I think most of us in Britain don't realise how lucky we are to live by European health and food standards as opposed to American ones. And part of the plot here, I think, is that Boris Johnson and his cronies have consistently wanted to throw away European Union regulations and introduce much laxer American regulations so that they can import chicken bathed in chlorine from America, from beef laden with hormones from Australia. They want to do all of these things because they want to make money, and also because it shows the independent. It shows just how independent Britain is. And what the last few weeks have shown is just how dependent Britain is on its major trading partner in the European Union. I really can't see any way out of it. They're going to negotiate. There's going to be ugly car crashes. There's going to be staring each other in the face. There's going to be bellowing and bickering and sniping as well, in that you'll find container loads of sausages on their way to Northern Ireland being impounded. And the latest one is COVID, where perfectly legal accepted COVID vaccines have to be get export and import permissions both sides, even though 6 months ago they didn't have to do that. This is the type of restriction that is just going to keep on unfolding. It's the gift that Brexit keeps on giving. And you either walk Brexit back, or you live with it and wallow in the consequences of empty supermarket shelves, fields with no agricultural workers, truck drivers who aren't there, and the trucks aren't. I think the Bank of England today did it save £440 million a week foregone in growth as a result of Brexit. And this is the Bank of England, which is the Conservative sort of home, back pocket economic consultant. It is an unmitigated disaster, and it will carry on being an unmitigated disaster, and that's entirely foreseeable.
Okay. Now, James, massive problems have been created for Britain's Northern Ireland by imposing checks on transit of goods with EU member Ireland. The UK has so far voluntarily, kept the checks suspended. So is renegotiation the solution to the problem?
Well, renegotiation is written into Article 16, which is what Lord Frost is talking about in voting. If you read the details of the Northern Ireland Protocol, it says that Article 16, yes, either side can invoke it, but it's not really unilateral, like your reporter said. They have to give a one-month notification to the other party, the UK to the EU or vice versa, and they have to, and then you start negotiating straight away, and the measures have to be limited to dealing with the problem at hand, and they have to be temporary, and the negotiations are all about finding a way to end, putting an endpoint on those measures. So it's not apocalypse, they're not tearing up the treaty. They're not tearing up the Northern Ireland Protocol here. So, the problem has been, it's mainly to do with, there's a few things, but largely it's to do with chilled meats, that's ready-made meat products, which are, for the supermarket shelf that are going over there. And the effect has been essentially that Irish producers, which export to Britain anyway, have, to mainland Britain, have kind of cleaned up, and they've got a monopoly there. They're supplying everybody up in Northern Ireland. So, and British suppliers want to do it. But there's other things. Obviously, the political situation there in Northern Ireland, the DUP is it's caused a crisis in the DUP, where they've actually gone through two leaders in a few months. And the new leader is taking a very hard line, because that reflects how unionists feel about this. And, you know, let's say Sinn Féin, the main Republican Party, has a belief that enough unionists want to stay in the EU that much from stemming from the result of the Brexit referendum up there, that they'll turn around and they'll say, okay, well, you know, maybe we'll vote to actually reunify with the Republic of Ireland. That's not going to happen. Okay, don't get into that. Is that, you know, ultimately, I think this is going to go on. It's a kind of negotiating thing. A lot of the language that's being used is very dramatic, but it's basically just a negotiating position. And perhaps the way out of it is going to be some kind of deal between Britain and the EU, which covers agricultural products, including fresh meat, that gets you out of it. And it doesn't become, it will no longer be an issue. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, Ian, as regards the renegotiation, the European Commission says that this will lead to even further instability for both people and businesses. Do you share the same view?
Well, you know, the thing about negotiations is they're usually about solid, concrete things. You know, you weigh your Irish pound of sausages against the Danish bacon coming in the other way, and you know, you produce some type of equivalence. But here we've got nationalism and wounded feelings. We have the Northern Ireland Unionists who wanted to be part of Britain, who voted for Britain to come out of Brexit with the direct out of the European Union, with the direct consequence that it attenuates the links, that it stretches the links in Ireland, which they don't want, because they don't want a border, amazingly enough, between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. They want it open for a commercial consequence. So there's this continuous interface between commercial and rational negotiation and the nationalism. And it's not just on the Northern Irish side. I mean, the whole thing about Brexit is people, I think we underestimate this, people who voted for Brexit are quite prepared to suffer empty supermarket shelves, lack of fresh fruit, the fact that they can't get builders and truck drivers, because it satisfies their nationalist feelings, their xenophobic feelings, because at least we haven't got Romanians picking the blackberries. You know, at least we haven't got Poles doing the plumbing. We can wait a bit longer to get the toilet fixed, but we have not any Poles here, and that's what really matters. I mean, I think we've,
okay, that's all fantasy.
Like in 1840, we've underestimated the extent to which xenophobia and nationalism and pride plays a part in this, and we're seeing that with the Northern Irish. I mean, hey, nobody knows about irrational prejudice like the Northern Irish.
Okay, James can't wait to give a reaction to what you said. James, go ahead.
Well, firstly, I mean, I haven't seen any empty supermarket shelves. The supermarkets here stock down here in Plymouth. And, you know, when you see photos of that, you often see in the background the other shelves. The one shelf is empty, the other shelves are full. We had an electrician in a few weeks ago. He's Polish. He's staying here because actually about 5 million people asked from the EUR have applied for long-term residency and got it. There's a huge amount of building work going on around here. I've got two houses that I can see out of my window, there's a whole housing estate where they're changing the rooms, and there's a couple of private houses where they're doing it. And every day up on the street I see a lorry coming from a company that one of about five different companies that I've seen that are training lorry drivers, because the wages for lorry drivers have suddenly jumped up because there's a bit of a labour shortage, and that labour shortage is not just in the UK, it's all over Europe and most of the world, actually. And it's probably more to do with the lockdown than anything, the COVID-19 lockdown. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of problems with that. You know, there isn't a hard border. There wasn't a hard border between the UK and Ireland before the EU even existed, and there isn't now. There is a unilateral agreement that's about 100 years old called the Common Travel Area, which means that every citizen of the UK and every citizen of Ireland can travel freely between the two without even a passport and live indefinitely without a visa and work, and they get full voting rights. It's actually much better than the rights, the non-rights that you get in your so-called freedom of movement within the EU, because I lived in Spain for 5 years and I had very limited rights. I did not have the rights of a Spanish person. So, but an Irish person living in the UK or a British person living in Ireland has full citizens' rights. And there's also a free trade agreement between the UK and the EU, which the Northern Ireland Protocol is part of. So there is actually no great impediment of moving goods across the border. And this is the stuff, this is the issue that was supposed to make the Northern Ireland Protocol imperative, because out of an argument that it would breach the border checks between Northern Ireland and the Republic would breach the Good Friday Agreement. I don't think they would, to be honest. I think there is a great deal of free, there is freer movement across that border than there is between most sovereign states.
All right. Now, Ian, London says it had no choice other than delaying the post-Brexit trade controls, and that's because of global pressure on supply chains. Is the UK in the right?
Global pressure on supply chains. It sounds almost like the type of shortages we're just saying weren't happening. Now, there is a global pressure on supply chains, and it's particularly acute on the entirely foreseeable sort of narrow links, like across the channel, where the Conservative government seemed to be amazed the cross-channel traffic goes through the channel ports. The Conservatives were amazed at this. They're so far away from reality most of the time. Similarly, they don't really know what's happening in between Northern Ireland and the mainland. Between the Great British mainland. They had no idea of the routes that this stuff took. They were negotiating in blind insouciance because of their nationalism. They really do not have the facts at their fingertips. And that's what they're continuing to prove that. There are repercussions on this. Don't underestimate them. I mean, there are the nationalists in Northern and Southern Ireland are sort of thinking, maybe the time to call for the referendum that was in the Good Friday Agreement. Because one of the things is that as soon as there's a prospect of a majority wanting unification of Ireland in Northern Ireland, they're supposed to be calling the referendum. It hasn't happened yet, but somebody's waiting to trigger it, and we can be sure that if the current government in London carries on with its willful disregard of everybody else's opinions, they're likely to precipitate it, just like they're on the way to precipitating Scottish independence, even as they officially fight against it. They are incredibly incompetent. That's the top and bottom of it. They came out of Brexit with no clear plan, because as I've said before here, Boris Johnson not only didn't want Brexit, he thought he was going to lose. This was an internal weapon for him to fight to win the Tory leadership. And when it won, he didn't know what to do with it. They had no ground plan. They didn't have any foresight. They didn't have a white paper saying, well, in that case, this is what we must do. They've had to make it up on the hoof as they've gone along, and their hooves are cloven in every sense. It's diabolical what they've done. On almost every turn, they've been wrong-footed by the EU. And after being insulted by these people for decades, the bureaucrats in Brussels are saying, well, up yours. We don't care. We don't really see any reason to bend over backwards to accommodate. We've got a London government that's basically said we're prepared to rip up agreements in international law because it's inconvenient. We don't have to talk to you about it. So their reaction is, go ahead. They don't really care whose sausages get into Northern Ireland. It's not a big issue, but it is for the voters in Britain. And this is, the British press and the British government persists in thinking that we're talking about equal partners here. Britain is a very minor part of Europe, and it's made itself even more minor. It's made itself even more ineffectual by pulling out. It has far more weight inside than it does as a negotiating partner outside. At least inside, it had the benefits of an implicit veto. Outside, all it's got is I'll stamp my feet and I'll scream if you don't give me what I want. And they say, go, scream, stamp your feet, see if we can care.
Interesting. Now, James, there's some who are arguing that UK's postponing the trade controls would give European firm exporters a commercial advantage over British firms. Is that true?
Sorry, I don't really understand that argument. Can you elaborate on that?
The question is that there are some people who say that postponing the trade controls would give European exporters a commercial edge over British firms.
Well, I don't know about that, because, I mean, the whole point is that they're trying to, put a stop to this, and, they're delaying, they're kicking the can down the road to allow British firms to keep, shipping goods to Northern Ireland under the same terms that they had before, under the same conditions that they had before. The advantage was largely that I can see is that Irish chilled meat producers kind of got a monopoly on the Northern Ireland market for a while, and they still have that advantage. You see, I don't see how that happens. I mean, what you get actually is a lot that trade associations do say a lot of things that don't actually make sense, like. The Hauliers Association here was complaining, was saying that people were going to starve to death or something in Britain because there weren't enough lorry drivers, and that everyone's training to be a lorry driver now. But what they were really complaining about was that they had to cut wages. You see, the Confederation of British Industry has some plan, has some suggestion that it wants a kind of common veterinary agreement between the UK and the EU, so that there's no question of transmitting animal diseases like foot and mouth, for instance, and so forth, and meat is all produced at the same standard. So, which would eliminate the issue at the heart of this, and there wouldn't be any problems with the control. I don't see how it would give them an advantage. I mean, also, what have we got? I mean, we have most goods are essentially able to move through between the UK and the EU anyway at this point, so what's changing? See, I'd like to address that. I mean, the thing about the political situation, and I'd like to come back to that briefly, in Northern Ireland, this has become a very touchstone issue there, and it's polarised people, and what I think it's probably done is it's persuaded all those unionists who did quite a lot of them voted against leaving the EU. It's driven them very firmly back into the unionist camp. You know, it's a question now between Brexit and being part of the, reunification with the Republic. And for them, it's okay, they're going to choose Brexit, they're going to choose staying in the UK and Brexit. So I think it's probably entrenched the position, and, for the Republicans who want to who are seeking a referendum, a border poll, as they say, on reunification. I think they're in stalemate basically with that. So there's no movement on that. There's going to be no movement there. But I think ultimately there will be, there has to be negotiation, because every time you press the Article 16 button, it triggers a series of negotiations, and there will be an outcome. And also, I'd say just one thing. I mean, what you said there about not knowing what they were doing. They knew what they were doing. Boris Johnson, he's guilty of mis-selling the Northern Ireland Protocol and the whole post-Brexit trade agreement.
Okay, James, sorry, I got to jump in. We are out of time. I'm very sorry for jumping in.
Okay.
I want to thank our guests. We had senior analysts with Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams in New York, and journalist and political commentator James Twitty, who joined us from Plymouth. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behruz Najaf.
the limelight.
A new analysis shows that a large portion of Pentagon contracts in recent years have gone to just five companies: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading, "Up to half of the $14 trillion spent by Pentagon since 9/11 has gone to war profiteers." Stay tuned for more. To half of the estimated $14 trillion that the Pentagon has spent in the two decades since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan has gone to private military contractors, with corporate behemoths such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Dynamics hovering up much of the money. That's according to a new paper authored by William Harting, director of the Arms and Security Program at the Center for International Policy, and released recently by Brown University's Cost of War Project. Published just days after the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks and 2 weeks after the last U.S. military plane departed Afghanistan, the paper documents the extent to which the massive post-9/11 surge in Pentagon spending benefited weapon makers, logistics firms, private security contractors, and other corporate interests. The magnitude of Pentagon spending in the wake of 9/11 attacks was remarkable, Harting observes. The increase in U.S. military spending between fiscal year 2002 and fiscal year 2003 was more than the entire military budget of any other country, including major powers like China, Russia, the U.K., Germany, and France. According to Harting's analysis, from one-third to one-half of Pentagon's $14 trillion in spending since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan on October 21 went to defense contractors, which spend heavily on government lobbying. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, Harting writes, adding, the $75 billion in Pentagon contracts received by Lockheed Martin in fiscal year 2020 is well over 1.5 times the entire budget for the State Department and Agency for International Development for that year, which totaled $44 billion. But those five corporate giants are far from the only companies that profited from the increase in U.S. Defense Department outlays following the Afghanistan invasion, which ultimately killed more than 46,000 Afghan civilians. Harting notes that numerous other firms, including Eric Prince's since rebranded Blackwater, the Dick Cheney tied company Halliburton, and DynCorp, benefited handsomely from the Pentagon spending boom. Halliburton's Pentagon contracts grew more than tenfold from FY 2002 to FY 2006 on the strength of its contracts to rebuild Iraq's oil infrastructure and provide logistical support for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan, the new paper reads, adding, by 2009, over half of DynCorp revenues were coming from the Iraq and Afghan wars. Hartung argues that the Pentagon's growing reliance on private contractors to carry out U.S. foreign policy in the aftermath of 9/11 attacks raises multiple questions of accountability, transparency, and effectiveness. This is problematic because privatizing key functions can reduce the U.S. military's control of activities that occur in war zones while increasing risks of waste, fraud, and abuse, he writes, adding, additionally, that the waging of war is a source of profits can contradict the goal of having the U.S. lead the diplomacy in seeking to resolve conflicts. In order to rein in war profiteering and increase government accountability over private firms involved in conducting or preparing for war, Hartung recommends several broad policy changes, including slashing overall spending on war and military operations overseas, increasing the role of diplomacy in U.S. foreign policy, implementing more strict regulations and strengthening the role of inspectors general, auditors, and contracting officers in rooting out corruption, and enacting revolving door reforms such as longer cooling off periods between government service and employment in the arms industry, closing loopholes in current laws, and increasing detailed reporting on revolving door employment. Reducing the profits of war ultimately depends on reducing the resort to war in the first place, Hartung writes. Likewise, making war less profitable decreases the incentive to go to war. Given the immense financial and human costs of America's post-9/11 wars and the negative security consequences generated by many of these conflicts, adopting a new, less militarized foreign policy should be a central goal of the public and policymakers alike, unquote.